But anyway, we are running a few minutes late here, so we'll get this rolling here. This is a panel on aesthetics and Doctor Who, and I'm just going to go ahead and introduce people very quickly here. Their details are in the program guide if people, when they present, they want to say a little bit more on this. Starting on my right, Pierce Britton, Lynn Thomas, Robert Levy, I'm Derek Compere, Tammy Garrison, and Philip Sandifer. So I think the way we're going to go with this, if it's okay, we'll go basically in that same order. Would that work? And just have the comments on there, and then we can come back around and add and dispute and so forth with that. And so I guess we'll start with Piers.
Starting with Piers. Piers Britton, easy to remember. Britton by name, British by birth. I probably have bear some responsibility for this panel existing. I wanted something that dealt with aesthetics, both because I've written on problems of wrestling with television aesthetics as an idea, in the specific case of Doctor Who, in the book that I wrote a couple of years ago, and also because my principal interest that led me to write that book in the first place in Doctor Who, as an academic as opposed to as a fan, though actually one can't really divide the two, is in design. And a lot of my work is on design for television and film, specifically costume design. That's been my great interest. And I used to give a talk using a very ropey old VHS copy of State of Decay. There was a moment, a totally inconsequential moment, when the Doctor, played by Tom Baker, wearing the outfit that my dear friend June Hudson created for him, is walking towards the TARDIS through a wood. And you see his back. He goes into the TARDIS, and that's the end of the shot. And to me, age whatever I was, 10, 11, having been a Doctor Who fan since I was 5, that was a gorgeous moment, partly because it was the first time I realized that costume is inherently interesting, because June is a wonderful designer and made the back of Tom Baker's coat as interesting as the front of it is. So I don't really have a great deal to say. I have nothing specifically prepared, nothing that it didn't go the way of my flash drive that unfortunately died between my home and Chicago. Yes. The ceremony later. Interment at sea or something. But what I will say is this, that for me, a great deal of the appeal of Doctor Who, which is something that is transcendent in that it, the whole is great, continues to be the greater than the sum of its parts. We all have our passions. A number of people have come out in favor of David Tennant's Doctor, whom I cordially detest, I'm sorry to say. But Doctor Who continues to engage and engross, and part of the reason I think for that is that there's something that, I won't say it's indefinable because I'm very interested in trying to define it, but a good way of capturing it, I think, is something I think Norman Mailer said about Marilyn Monroe, that in the end, Marilyn is a mood. And I think that a lot of that engrosses the comments that have been made in both of the two preceding panels, that there's a something that's Doctor Who-ish. If there's a something that is the character of the Doctor, then there's a something that we recognize and gravitate towards and can't leave, I think, for many of us, love it or hate it, that is Doctor Who-ish. And so if we can find ways of characterizing that aesthetically, or using aesthetics, or problematizing aesthetics, that's something I think Doctor Who offers us rich potential to do because of its idiosyncrasy. So that's my initial pitch. Nothing much more to say. Moving on.
Hi, I'm Lynn Thomas. I'm one of the co-editors of Chickstick Time Lords, and I'm one of the contributors to the Verity podcast. And if you listen to the last Verity podcast episode, you will notice that we have a bit of an obsession with the skirts and dresses that Clara is wearing at the moment, which may be why I'm sitting here. I also can provide extensive commentary upon all of Romana 2's costuming, as well as inappropriate footwear through the ages of Doctor Who.
I have feels.
I have lots of feels about what people wear and how they talk about it, and I also have lots of feels about things like monster design and set design. And what it's like to be a show at the BBC that very few people are willing to work on, and how you get sometimes transcendent design because people get excited for once, and sometimes things that are just god-awful because they could care less, and how that affects the show. So I'm kind of all over the place, but that should not surprise any of you who have ever seen me on a panel ever. So that's me. Hi. And I'm caffeinated, so here we go.
Hi, my name is Rob Levy. I do a radio show on KDHX in St. Louis called Juxtaposition. You can listen online. For some insane reason, I agreed for my friend Jonathan to write a weekly Doctor Who column for Anglotopia.net, which is now TARDIStopia.net. It's grown so well it has its own TARDIS site now, which is crazy. And I do a weekly Doctor Who column, which is interesting but also turning into a strange sort of fetishy kind of thing now, where it's like I spend way too much time with this than I thought I would.
Welcome to fandom.
I've been involved in fandom since 1983, but it's just like, this is like, okay, I'm always amazed at just the depths that everybody goes to. It's fascinating. So I did have a presentation prepared. It's on Psychic PowerPoint, so I hope you enjoy it. About 2 years ago, I was asked to do a presentation on Doctor Who in the 60s. So I started looking through the lens of Doctor Who in the 60s, which is one of my favorite eras, kind of like all of it. But so I started looking at the Troughton years, and I started noticing how much, particularly from the start of the Matt Smith Doctor to now, although now didn't exist then, how much he's borrowed from the Patrick Troughton era, particularly season 5 of 1967 and 1968. Everything from fezes, lots of different hats, sunglasses, the suspenders, the bow tie, obviously the sonic screwdriver unit. The idea too, from a production standpoint, of how they do the scoring of the episodes for the episodes with the music, how they did the edits, sort of the edits, the visual edits, physical edits, and just a lot of this stuff paralleling on how they're producing the show now as how they made it then. And it's significantly interesting how much they're borrowing from it. And then, completely unbeknownst to me, Stephen Moffat, who must have clearly read my paper, decided that he was going to put the Ice Warriors and the Great Intelligence in this season. Thank you very much. So that's the nuts and bolts of kind of what I do. One of the magical things for me about Doctor Who is I'm the nerd that likes to spot everything that was in something else before. So I'm interested in that. And I also collect the Doctor Who pop records. So,
do you have Doctor in Distress?
I have 8 copies of them, one signed by every doctor, plus the bands. So I just got Midge last month, or Billy Curry last month. But so yes, I have all the weird.
Wow.
And I have the original 9 covers of the Doctor and the TARDIS 12-inch that didn't get released. So yeah, that's my sort of weird thing. I'm really into like the history of the Radiophonic Workshop, and so that's kind of my background from it aesthetically.
Thanks. I've got a longer piece on this on my blog, decompare.wordpress.com, if you want to check it out. In terms of sound design is what I wanted to focus a little bit on. I'm interested in everything in terms of design here. Just want to focus a little bit on the sound. You're talking about the Time Lords and the Doctor in Distress. Doctor in Distress as well, though.
Right? Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's two different things.
Comma. All right.
My obsession's been with Doctor Who audio in some ways. I was one of those people that made cassette copies of the music before,
yes.
You know, in addition to the music albums that were on there. And so I've thought a lot about the music and the sound effects and everything. One thing in contextualizing the whole series, though, that I've noticed is thinking about differentiating between classic series and the new series in terms of the sound design overall. And the big argument I want to make here is that initially, if we have sound effects, dialogue, and music, initially sound effects was on top of that distinction in the 1960s. That the one of the big things that distinguishes Doctor Who from every other show that's out there at the time is it just sounds like nothing else that's out there. The very first opening bits of the show, the amazing Delia Derbyshire theme tune, or rendition of Ron Grainer's theme tune, leads into, of course, the exterior hum of the TARDIS, right? This police box that's humming. This is a fantastic moment. And throughout the 60s then, and even into the 70s to a great extent, the sound effects are alien, they're unusual, the Radiophonic Workshop is creating them, the sort of burbling laboratories. I always think of the Troughton area, you know, something's always going in the background as part of that. Fast forward a bit just for time here, in terms of to the very end of the show, the McCoy era, which we were championing last time, I think that's the period that actually marks this shift into the sound design where Kev McCulloch and Murray Gold are actually spiritual partners in a lot of ways, I want to suggest, because the music becomes overwhelming to the sound mix in the 1980s. The sound effects by that point are normative because everybody has heard every sort of digital sound effect you can do by the 1980s because of the synthesizers were being sold in storefronts and everything. So it wasn't really as much a big deal, but the music becomes driving it. The fact that the dialogue, which was sort of declarative and normative early in the 60s and 70s, becomes more distinctive. So Sylvester McCoy is the first Doctor who's actually allowed to be somewhat ethnic in a way. His Scottishness comes to the fore in a way that none of the previous Doctors were allowed to do. Colin Baker still complains bitterly to this day that he wasn't allowed to be Northern at all in the 1980s as Chris Eccleston was. And so by the time we get to the new series, the sound mix has been completely inverted from initially, so that sound effects are the last kind of layer we kind of take for granted in there. The action and adventure and plot is conveyed primarily through dialogue and primarily through Murray Gold's incredibly overbearing music, for the most part, on there. And I don't blame him specifically. I do blame the production team that's got that.
It's like sound mixers. What are you doing?
Yeah. There's a whole issue with the mix itself is a questionable sort of thing that comes in with that, but. It changes the nature of the show. It really changes the entire nature of the show and our experience of it because we're cued into the emotions a lot more. There's very few silences. I loved Hyde the other week. We're actually silent for a while. It's a rare occurrence in the new series for that. But aesthetically, it changes the dimensions of how we experience the show. And so I just wanted to focus a little bit on the sound and as an important part of the overall design.
Okay. I like shiny things. I come from a strange land where I used to work in an archive doing military reference of all things, and all of the history stuff got sloughed off onto me because I'm a huge history buff, and so I'm very interested in oddly hair on the show, where hair, fashion, things that date the show, even when they're in some historical period, that you can see that aesthetically it's really a product of its time, despite, the fact that they're hanging out with this historical figure or that. And it's kind of fun to go back and watch the older episodes, Mona Lisa, this one is fake, and everybody's just in like completely wrong costume and hair. What are you doing? But it's actually right and appropriate for the time period in which that episode took place, aesthetically for the culture, because you look at modern movies today, Western movies, and they have a very sort of modern aesthetic as far as the hair and costuming goes versus shiny Westerns from the 60s where, everybody had big beehive hair and lots of blue eye makeup, which, was sadly absent from the West in that period. it's like a little bit of gun smoke, aesthetic going on there. And I'm interested in that contrast. Where they try to be somewhat true to the historic period and yet at the same time appeal to a modern audience, or when they go into the future and it's Big Brother and people have, the same weird-ass hairstyles that they have on Big Brother now. And those sort of shifts and... where those two things sort of collide, historic accuracy and also not making it so foreign that a modern audience or especially children, since, it is supposed to be a kids' family show. I know, anathema. But, that a kid's not going to be completely alienated by, Shakespeare wearing the big thing and, all of that good stuff. So I like that place where all of that stuff intersects.
picking up just very briefly on your comments on, hair and datedness, I'm not the first to point out that nothing solves the unit dating problem quite like Sarah Jane's outfit. You can pretty much date the unit over the week. So one thing that, as we near the end of the third panel and the halfway mark, is you know, again, and again, picking up on the differences between U.S. treatment of Doctor Who and U.K. treatment of Doctor Who, you can tell this is an American conference because none of us have been spectacularly bitchy about Doctor Who. which,
if we're talking about the aesthetic
of Doctor Who, especially, you know, again, in the context of Britain, British Doctor Who fandom is the most wonderfully bitchy, snarky, sarcastic thing ever. And then the other thing that then strikes me is we've been talking about, you know, the generally accepted good bits of Doctor Who, as opposed to, like, you know, the web planet, the Macra Terror, the Curse of Peladon, the Rebos Operation.
I love the Gunfighter. But the flip side, and I could go on
and get this list to, you know, send every doctor, get, you know, the Happiness Patrol in there.
Hey, I love that episode.
And the thing is, the Happiness Patrol is one of my favorite things ever. I mean, I adore the Happiness Patrol. I think it's, you know...
But the historical inaccuracies in the gunfighters make me go. I'm like, Doc Holliday was not practicing dentistry at that period because he had epic consumption and he was making more money playing cards.
Right, but I mean, and I used, you know, the Web Planet and the Happiness Patrol actually as a bit of a litmus test with my wife. She adored both, so, you know, it all worked out. but the and my point in bringing these up is. I feel like the, you know, aesthetics of Doctor Who are, you know, and Doctor Who as an aesthetic, even still, even as it, you know, becomes a, you know, international hit again, we're strangely ashamed of the wonderfully rubbish bits. And I mean wonderfully rubbish. Mm-hmm. you know, I my list of, you know, Happiness Patrol, Curse of Peladon, and the Web Planet was in no way meant as disparaging. These are some of my absolute favorite moments of Doctor Who. Because who the hell tries to do the Web Planet on a, you know, 1960s Doctor Who budget, other than Doctor Who, apparently?
Well, they're redoing it for the well, they redid it for the special too, which will be interesting to see
how
it looks.
Yeah.
I mean, they redid it and called it the end of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the second episode of the new series, right down to having the robotic spider crash into the camera, just as one of the aliens does in the Web Planet, in this gorgeous little homage. Because, you know, Russell, this is very much the Doctor Who Russell T. Davies loves, is, you know, these wonderfully weird crap bits.
can we
use the word camp, please?
Yes, I would love to, because especially because that gets at another, you know, fundamental fact about, you know, American versus British Doctor Who fandom. You know, we the first panel talked about the fact that, you know, British Doctor Who conventions were overwhelmingly male. What that missed is they were also overwhelmingly gay.
Yeah.
I mean, British Doctor Who fandom, it surprised no one British that Doctor Who's revival came out of Queer as Folk. It was only Americans who were at all, you know, blindsided by that move. You know, so that's very much, you know, also an important thing of Doctor Who. So, you know, just as sort of my opening statement, I'd like to, when we talk about the aesthetics of Doctor Who, point out camp, point out a sort of gleeful weirdness and strangeness for the sake of just seeing what you can get away with and what you can do, and point out that I think, you know, very much loving Doctor Who fandom is about loving the Web Planet, loving the Happiness Patrol, loving the moment where, you know, just as you're starting to go, okay, this is a very straightforward little, you know, allegory about fascist states and everything, what the hell is that giant man made of candy doing on my television screen? And I, you know, if we're going to say what is, you know, the aesthetic of Doctor Who, I think it's the moment where the Candyman appears on the screen and the entire audience just goes, what the hell is going on in my life now? I don't understand anything.
That's the aesthetic of Doctor Who.
We joke about the Candyman, but there were memos to the BBC from Downing Street about the Candyman.
They had to swear never to use it again.
Because it was too much like the licorice all sorts.
Right, it was ripped off of a corporate icon.
I was scared of the licorice all sorts for a long time after that. Like, my great-grandmother would, like, buy a bag of them, and she'd open them, and I'd be like, no, thank you, I'm good.
Well, I mean, and the Web Planet's ratings beat anything like a new series has ever done. I mean, that hit, like, 11, 12 million people for, you know, the Zarbi.
Vaseline and moth suits.
Yep.
Put that on BBC America.
Well, I hate to be horribly po-faced, but I am going to offer a little bit of a rejoinder. This is a hobby horse of mine. But one of the things that fascinates me, the last couple of things I've written have been about the rhetoric around design in Doctor Who. And we've heard it said so many times by the British press and now program makers themselves that Doctor Who is all wobbly sets. I mean, I've seen more sets wobble in the new series than I ever saw wobble in the old. We're talking about wobbling as opposed to sort of global crapness.
Toby Haydock has actually documented the number of wobbly sets in the classic series, and it's like three.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, and you know, you saw wobbly sets on police procedurals.
Yep.
People would slam a door and the whole wall would vibrate. So one of the things I've tried to say over the years is that Doctor Who was actually this crucible in which spectacular design work was done.
Yes.
And yes, it may have been done on Sevenpence Halfpenny, and the web planet may be risible in retrospect for all kinds of reasons, but the inventiveness and the ethos of the BBC, how the BBC functioned as an entity that supported inventive work, by default, in a way, but still supported it, led to wonderful things. The robots and the robots of death, to me, are some of the most beautiful things that were ever designed for any science fiction. You know, the list could go on.
You know, in the Third Doctor era, they did wonderful things with condoms filled with jellies. So, you know.
Thank you for bringing that up.
They elevated the use of condoms as.
And with color and editing, though. I mean, the Pertwee era is jaw dropping in a number of ways. When you remember that, you know, color television has been around a handful of years. For all that is wrong with the Claws of Axos, and, you know, Rob and I were talking about this at dinner last night. My God, that thing looks like nothing else on television before or since.
We should also talk about the technical aspect of the aesthetic, because Doctor Who is one of the shows that pioneered the use of color separation overlay in a way that a lot of other shows then picked up on later.
Right.
You know, Barry Letts was a huge
overlay
influence.
Huge.
And I mean, one could argue that he used it a wee bit too much.
Really?
But
I have a lot of feels about the set photos from Marco Polo. Because they're color and they're brilliant and they're beautiful and vibrant and
toy maker.
And it's just like, I mean, it kills me that, like, it was so beautiful, and not only have we lost parts of it, but the stuff that we have is like dull black and white.
Well, that goes to Pierre's point, though, and I think that we have an unfair comparison sometimes between the classic series and the new series, because the new series, when they go on the cheap, it's just as sort of obvious and awful that they use the corridors, the Millennium Stadium, you know, and a few cartons again, and bits of you know, insulation or whatever. And ooh, we're on Akatan now, you know, and those sorts of things. So.
And I want to, you know, I agree with you. The Web Planet Not even for all its faults, because of all of its faults, is jaw-dropping. I mean, I remember the About Time books and their review of it slagging it off for looking like television in the 1920s, which, first of all, given that it's the only instance of television in the 1920s you're ever going to find, I don't know why. but second of all, Stephen Moffat, I remember in an interview, made the, I thought, wonderfully brilliant point that, you know, for all that you can complain about how badly the BBC did the Planet Vortis, you'll go over and look at Zed cars, and they couldn't do cars, and those are right out in the parking lot.
There's,
you know, I mean, I agree. What Doctor Who accomplished, not even for its budget, but for its ambition, is wonderful. That's the thing. Why I'm, you know, so eager to embrace the wonderful crap of Doctor Who is because it's so madly and uncaringly ambitious.
Well, and every show is a product of its era. I mean, Dark Shadows is wonderful and beautiful and extremely slow-paced, but it, you know, the style sense, even the historic bits, I mean, they're it's like, whoa, 1960s. You're rearing your ugly head. And, you know, even Buffy, I mean, stuff that we love, you and Babylon 5, you go back and look at it now, and you're like, whoa, CG, man.
Well,
and at the time we were like, whoa, CG, holy crap.
And we'll be like that now. I mean, if we judge by those sort of standards, as we were talking about this a little bit last night, you know, the Christopher Eccleston year already looks, you know, dated in this sort of way, if that's our criteria, you know. But again, embracing what you're saying, it doesn't matter in some ways.
Right. Yeah. It's a product of its era, and I think we should embrace that instead of being like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the amazing things about the aesthetics is that in terms of design, what you end up with because of the ambition is that when design fails, when things do go horribly wrong, and of course they do because they're making sets and costumes on nothing, It's always a fiasco rather than a true failure. It's always a function of they tried and they reached so far that you end up with really amazing physical performances of people in a bit crap butterfly costumes, essentially.
Right. Well,
but they're trying really, really hard, and it's always the failure comes out of the mode of overreaching what they have the time and money to do, as opposed to a failure of imagination, as opposed to a failure of design aesthetics. It's always a function of how can we make this completely astonishing? And we might not quite get to astonishing, but it's never a lack of imagination. They never go, oh, well, yeah, I guess we'll just, you know, have everybody wear tweed.
Yeah. You know? Well, and they also, like...
Robert.
Yeah, I'll just,
sorry.
Just go home.
No, I can just go I'm home. That guy, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. The one thing I did want to say about Doctor Who that's been interesting that the old series does that the new series hasn't really done, and we're starting, I think, this season to see that as a result of a casualty of that, is that Doctor Who, as in the classic series, was always able to push the envelope because it didn't have a large budget, because it had to rely on recycling costumes or doing interesting things with set designs or moving things in different ways. Now it's got a massively huge budget, a worldwide budget from two different continents. So does having sort of that constantly having to push the envelope with technology mean we're losing some of the quality and the magic of the show we all loved?
I mean, they have some stuff that looks nowadays like really horrible CGI in the 80s episodes. But at the same time, like, that was innovation, that was cutting edge, that was, you know, that was the Star Wars of its time, and I'm not feeling that sense of, you know, them pushing the envelope. They're using all the tools that they have with the CG and stuff, but they're not really, you know, creating new things.
The best part of Trial of Time was that opening, that little opening bit.
That opening shot.
The beginning, which
they
later...
shot that
they spent
all
their like,
budget on.
And it's like, okay, that was great. Can I just see that again? I mean, at the time, that was like... When we watched that on our grainy VHS tapes that got shipped over from England, you know, you know, I mean, that looked really amazing. Mm-hmm. And now, it, like, it still looks okay, but what would they do with it now?
Well, and part of it, too, in terms of the CG these days, CG is everywhere.
Yeah.
CG is in everything, and so it's really this everyday kind of quotidian thing. And so when it looks a little off on there, I think... we're much less, you know, it strikes out
we're
even
less
more
forgiving,
because, yeah,
yeah,
it just...
Because,
it,
you know, you watch Brave and every curl of that girl's hair is moving in a different direction.
That's the only reason I wanted to ask her to,
I think there are a couple of things to say. First of all, it's not just the constraints of budget. It's also the fact that BBC trained designers. Mm-hmm. It had either long-standing affiliations or in-house people who do everything. And excellence built upon excellence. Mm-hmm. And it was a watchword. Now everything's farmed out. That brings its own problems. But you know the issue of datedness. I think it's also a function of how we look. It's not just that things are better now than they were 10 years ago. I mean, going back to again my lovely friend June Hudson, she said if I was designing Doctor Who now, I would have to do it differently from the way that I did in 80, because at that time it showed on Saturday. One 4-part serial would be repeated the following summer, and that was it, folks. There was no thought of VHS, was nothing. Now, clearly, the Davis and Moffat Doctor Who is a prima facie examples of this. They're not the only ones. But this is television made for the DVD age. It's made now for the Blu-ray age that we can see with precision, and we will watch over and over and over again, many of us here for all kinds of personal reasons, but audiences at large, you know, that don't have cult investments or whatever you want to call them, will watch over and over and over again because it's possible, it's easy, it's almost more difficult not to. And therefore, I teach a class with June where she comes and intensively for a month puts students, some of whom we've never drawn before, through what it means to be a costume designer, what it means to be a costume designer on Doctor Who. And she did this lovely drawing this last, she always works alongside the students, so this last year that she came and talked with me last May, where she picked up a little element of an asymmetrical 1930s pendant. She put it on the back of a dress, the same detail. Mm. I said, that's glorious. She said, well, you have to do this now, because this is going to be watched and relished. it's going to enter into the fabric of people's consciousness.
And it's going to be in HD, and they're going to pause every frame.
And look at details. Mm-hmm. And also, with the rise of cosplay as well, there's more of an attention to it than there was in the 80s when I started watching, it's like, okay, costuming was a guy showing up in a scarf.
Well,
and
unless
now,
you're Lala Ward. Lala Ward paid a lot of attention to her costume.
Oh, yeah.
For good reason. I mean, the run of Lala Ward's costumes is one of the best of the classic series because she paid attention and she made demands about it.
I mean, I think like Katie Manning, Lala Ward, and then on into the new series, you start to see a sort of, like, I have the money to spend on costumes. They're going to give it to me. I'm going to use it. And it's really interesting, like you talked about Lala Ward. It's really, I mean, even Mary Tam, her companion really sort of had this interesting fashion sense to it.
Yeah.
And I never
she had an outfit for every occasion.
And, you know, as a dude, I never really paid attention to fashion as a component of the show until the Romana era. And then I'm like, they're using that to play off of the physical presence of the Doctor. And the whole, and I was like, I love the show even more now.
Yeah.
See, I overread into Mary Tam's footwear so hard. like, what is it? Stones of Blood?
Yes,
where she's wearing these strappy
gold sandals.
Strappy gold sandals. And you're like, this is so not appropriate. It's not like you've not ever been on an adventure with the Doctor before. You know there's going to be running. And the only conclusion that I can draw is that, like, she's trying to, you know, say, pay attention to me.
No, that's why they have the line about flying in City of Death, to retcon that to sensibility.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, that, she Circle wants him to do the all square. The work. Yeah. She's perfectly happy to stand around and look gorgeous and let him do some work for a change.
But then she's, like, taking off the shoes, and she's like, you know, this is horrible. And it's like, you put them on, man.
You made a choice there.
You made live with it. Run in the strappy heels.
I want to return to that point about about the 80s, because I agree with you in terms of the design in the 80s wasn't actually worse for the 80s than like the design in the 60s 80s. Or 70s.
Exactly, yeah.
It was the 80s.
I mean, for all the people, you know, slag the John Nathan Turner era, and I think there are many, many good reasons to do that for much of it. If you watch other, you know, British television of the era, if you pull up the Cleopatras is a great one to like hunt down somewhere and watch alongside season 19, season 20, because suddenly the giant snake in Kinda doesn't look at all weird. You know, that's very much, you know, it actually did look a lot like other TV from the era. It wasn't that it was a lot more crap. I think it was actually that the ambition drained out, that you had, you know, getting back to what you said, that it was a cult show, and it was much more interested in doing, let's bring back a classic monster, let's do something for nostalgia, let's make Ian Levine happy, if we want to go to pure production terms here. And unsurprisingly, the larger British public abandoned it. And so I wonder, you know, I agree that there's not nearly the sense of textural wonder anymore.
Well, but I, just to go with the 80s, I think the pivot again is the McCoy era in some ways, because by that point they're like, what the hell? We've got nothing else to lose at this point. Let's kind of go for it. So the classic example is The Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
Yes.
So they have, what was it, a strike or a technical thing that moved
it? It was asbestos, I think.
It was asbestos, that's right. They had to move it outside. Great, it's a circus tent. We'll put that up, and it worked beautifully in that episode.
Well,
so they turned that into a virtue.
And you had the advantage of Andrew Cartmell there, who was, you know, young, hungry, and had nothing to lose because he was
on a show that nobody else wanted to
do. Right, and so all he had to go for was making a name for himself on sort of sheer ambition again, and it picked up.
And Sylvester McCoy got the benefit of having to have contribution to his costume, which Colin Baker never did.
Obviously,
you know?
Never did. But that also, and the fact that, you know, you have then the writing as part of what became experimental again in the McCoy era, and I wonder if that, you know, even in the face of Doctor Who looking almost shockingly good in the present day, I do, one thing that's jumped out at me throughout this new season is, my God, that this show is narratively experimental in terms of how fast it's willing to go. I mean, in terms of just how much it's willing to just cut out in almost like a slap in the face to any of us who like grew up on like well-groomed Aristotelian plotting, and then get away with it, you know, over and over again in terms of the larger audience. I mean, we, the fans, as we always do, are like sitting white-knuckled going, oh God, everyone's going to hate it and it's going to get canceled again. But all evidence is actually no, you actually can get away with this. And just the sheer degree to which the show is willing to move fast. Hyde, I loved the way in which Hyde at like the two-thirds mark has a fake ending, and then at the actual ending leaves off a little bit before the resolution. That it's this wonderfully chopped up, awkward structure that worked tremendously despite breaking all sorts of, you know, hard and fast aesthetic rules.
Well, and
I was just going to say, just as a good sort of segue to a larger sort of question with this, the production mode then of the classic series versus the new series, do you think, how much do you think that plays into
the
story choices and the design choices? Because, those six part, like you said, with season five, you know, it's one thing if we got an ice, you know, a base under siege, you know, for six episodes rather than in Hyde, we've got 44 minutes, go.
Interesting because, like, when you watch a lot of those, well, nobody can really watch season five. And like, Ian Levine can watch season five, but the rest of us, we're all here. But basically, what's interesting about season five is that they were told, make it a movie of the week, treat it like it's an American gunfight type of car chase show. So they tried to do with the episodes, and then they had to pad it out. So this is why you have these six episode ones that actually kind of work as six parters, and some that don't. But you see that again in the new series, where they're kind of like, there is sort of a directive about, you know, if it's gonna be, now they weren't thinking of America in 1967 and 68, but now they're definitely thinking of, you know, the American and the Australian audiences are really going to want to be go, 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 make it a movie of the week. And I don't know necessarily if the movie of the week concept isn't hurting it this year. I know this season, one of the great things about this year is it's been so divisive. And it's just great to see fans of the new show be as divisive about episodes as we were in 1985. You know, that's been great about it. Is that, you know, like, good, let's have some dialogue in here. Roll up your sleeves, fight it out, you know.
One of the interesting things about the structure of storytelling in the new series as opposed to the classic series is that, especially if you're talking about the classic series in 1963, you're dealing with an audience that have not spent their entire lives immersed in televisual storytelling.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You can break all kinds of rules in current Doctor Who right now, because each and every person who is tuning in is spending the bulk of their time consuming media that establishes and routinely breaks the storytelling rules of television and movies, and appreciates it in a way that an audience in 1963 who are experiencing television as essentially an extension of proscenium stage storytelling. Yeah. It's basically filming a play as live. I mean, that's how the show was shot in the 1960s, all the way through towards the end of the classic series, until they started breaking it up a little bit more. But at the very beginning of the series, they're running through the half-hour episode, roughly speaking, as live. They're doing it as a stage play with exactly two breaks, because that's all they could afford in terms of cutting the physical film. And that was, you know, they're running it as a stage play, and it's being shot like a stage play for the most part, because we have these big bulky cameras that cannot move about, and when they do, they often bump into parts of the set and it gets very messy. and your cables will knit themselves into a knot if you're not careful. Whereas with the new series, the way of shooting is completely different. We do rehearse, record, rehearse, record, rehearse, record. And as a result, you have a lot more flexibility in the editorial booth in terms of how you put the story together, and you have a much more savvy audience, because the experience of watching a narratively quite broken up or messy Doctor Who episode now feels like the experience of being a Doctor Who companion. There's someone much smarter than you who grabs you by the hand and says, let's go for a run, shall we? And you just go with it, and you hope you come out the other end with your sneakers still on.
Yeah.
But that's the experience of, it reflects the experience of being a companion of the Doctor in some ways, because you're dealing with an entity that is much more knowledgeable and much more wide-ranging than you, the consumer of this experience. And you're just kind of throwing yourself at it and hoping it turns out okay.
See, I think I almost entirely disagree. I mean, not...
Tell me more.
Mainly about the idea that the classic series wasn't pitched at high televisual literacy. I mean...
Robert Holmes was always aiming at the intelligent 12-year-old.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about something like The Gunfighters, where suddenly you have, you know, this ballad that's keeping the narrative.
Oh my God! Don't even talk to me about The Gunfighters.
Regardless of its quality, I feel like, you know, the thing to highlight here, though, is Doctor Who has always been challenging. The editing in
well,
the.
Well, I'm not saying it hasn't been. I'm saying that as we have gotten more savvy as viewers, Doctor Who has been able to become even more challenging.
We have a different visual vocabulary now than we used to.
I think its challenge has moved to a much more metafictional level as opposed to... But I feel like, like this idea of the strangeness of Doctor Who, and, you know, again, this strikes me as being about the way in which the show hasn't really changed in terms of its willingness to be challenging and strange. And again, when we talk about, you know, how divisive this season is in fandom, the ratings are about level, the AIs are about level, the British public seems to like it about as much as they have the last few years, because yeah. it's only us who seem to freak out about whether, like, the end of the world or Rings of Akkatan is going to suddenly alienate everyone.
And that's one of the interesting things, too, is that in Britain, okay, we lost 1 million viewers this week. It'll be okay. It's still Doctor Who. It's still the benchmark of the network. It'll be fine.
Well, it never falls
BBC
out of
it. America, if it drops off 1 million viewers, people are in suits in the morning freaking out. And it's an interesting dynamic now that we didn't have to, that as fans we never had to worry about. It's like, well, you know, honestly, if it goes off of BBC America, are any of us really going to cry? We'll just run to our computers, hypothetically.
Which are, but, like, and then unfortunately, they're two different, they're completely different audiences with completely different expectations.
Yeah.
And you're trying to appease everybody. And it's like.
Which is part of the thing I think that sort of hinders it now is that it's got so many masters now that it's. In many ways, it's not necessarily the best thing in the world.
I will
but
say,
it's television,
like
television, it's always had so many masters. Television has always been made by committee.
Yes,
like my litmus test is: will my Midwestern mother-in-law understand this without me having to pause it six times to explain what's going on? Usually, the average modern Doctor Who episode, we have to pause four times and explain what's going on. We watched Pyramids of Mars with her. She was constantly lost. and I'm just like, but this moves so slowly. And when the next episode comes on, they refresh your memory about what just happened before the commercial break. Well, why am I pausing this every 5 minutes?
Well, that's one of the fun things, though, about being a Doctor Who fan when we were young, is that how do I explain this to people? That was always kind of the fun part of it. And then when you met someone else that you could explain it to and they got it, like you mentioned before, that was awesome. But I think the other thing, though, that speaks about the current series, and I know it's always had several masters, but it's never had to depend on... We have to sell $500,000 ad rates. We have to cut 6 minutes out of the first showing is fine. The second and third showings, we cut 6 minutes out. Second one, 3 minutes out, 2 minutes out. At that point, it's artistically affecting the show as it's seen. So
if we can jump in here, we've got some time for some questions. Yeah, I just want to give the audience a chance to come in. So, yes, Tara.
Actually, I have three things. Okay, first. I was fascinated by the new series in its color palette. When
yes.
it came back, and you can parallel it with the late 60s, because in the late 60s, there was not the things that were the top things that Americans were watching did not have hugely varied color palettes. They were watching Gunsmoke, they were watching Man from U.N.C.L.E. They weren't necessarily watching The Green Hornet, Batman, and The Avengers. Whereas Doctor Who was definitely in the mode, color palette-wise, and also the use of oblique angles and the use of editing, much more in line with things like Batman and the Avengers. And when the show came back, it was in the height of Battlestar Galactica, which is American, monochrome, military, gray. And Doctor Who, the only program that it was visually similar to in its color palette and its saturation and also its angles was Farscape. So this was fascinating to me. It's not just because I have friends from music business who would intercut different series to create a new story, and you still have that visual continuity of the color palettes, but that Doctor Who was so visually different from speculative fiction in the States and the things that were the most critically acclaimed, even if they weren't the highest rated. So that was my first thing. Second thing, Moffat's era is doing much more with less. The idea that, they have this huge budget now, it's not quite as huge as you think.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
not what Russell T. Davies
yeah.
had to work with. And also going all out on the costuming budget, it's the BBC. Doing
yeah.
a historical and shooting it on location with rented costumes is actually the cheap route.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the States, shooting on location is vastly expensive compared to studio shooting. And so that is a fascinating thing to me. And we never talked about Barbara's hair in the Aztecs, for Pete's sake.
But it is interesting that the budget goes up every year for it since it's been back. That's been interesting.
But that's just inflation?
Yeah.
And the other thing is...
Well, they also get the height of it, hide some of it, because they get a budget from the American BBC now. Because of BBC America, they kick in a budget. So they have their quote-unquote on-paper British budget, but then they got the money coming in from the BBC worldwide as well that they can kind of hide in their final...
But not all that licensing money is actually going to the nuts and bolts production of the show.
Yeah. Well, it's not licensing money, it's more production money.
But it's not actually going into...
We don't see it on screen, is the
yeah.
point.
And the last thing that I wanted to mention is speaking of the pacing of the show, and it's not just Doctor Who that suffered this. Watch the Moonlighting pilot someday. We, people in their 30s and 40s, were part of the Spielberg-Lucas generation. We visually process information faster, and also television going from 56 minutes per episode down to 42 in the States means we are cutting to the chase faster. There are things that are written specifically to be cut, so if we are actually cutting out 6 minutes, they've already thought of that when they wrote the script. They've gone, okay, these are the bits that are going to get cut for pacing and time when it has to have another
Well, outbreak. Until Moffat came in, he didn't have control over what got cut from BBC America, which Russell didn't. So a lot of the Russell stories, when you see The Tenant and the Eccleston season, the cuts are really weird on BBC America. And because I'm one of the weird people that'll watch it and then watch the BBC America just to see how, because people are going to ask about it. And it's like night and day. It's really kind of fascinatingly weird and psychotic.
One of the things I wanted to say is, and this is a question, Hyde was fascinating to me because I had never seen something set in the 70s that actually looked like the 70s other than Life on Mars.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the aesthetics of Hyde versus one of the unit episodes from the 70s, which is actually taking place in the modern day, in terms of how they shot it, how they costumed it, the technology they used, just literally the props? I would love to see, since that episode just aired and it's a fresh comparison, like we've all got it in our heads.
This is the interesting thing. The first time I saw the set photo of Hyde, of all the tech and everything there, it seemed like a version of a Pertwee era.
Exactly.
You know, they're kind of quoting that. They're quoting Nigel Neal, you know, which many people have talked about. But they're doing it in an HD kind of way. So the stuff looks better, but it's
much prettier.
Narrative function
I noticed
is the same. Yeah. At a meta level, we're meant to think this is Doctor Who in the 70s kind of thing, but with a greater saturation. You had Jenna right there.
Oh, yeah, I was just curious, because you know, you were mentioning about your mother-in-law. Because what I find frustrating, and this is because it's the DVD era, is the whole, we have this week's story, but then we have our story arc, and all shows are doing this now. So what I often tell people is if you start, you really got to start with the first of the series, because I think if you turn the wheel, because all of a sudden you got the story going, and then this other thing is going on in the background.
I think jumping on points are really important. I mean, and coming from comics fandom, you know, where it's just like, you want to get into Batman or whatever, but you're like, where do I start? There are 75 years worth of comics. Fantastic. And so, you know, having a moment like the 11th hour where, you know, okay, we're making a clean break. We have a new doctor. We have new companions, new situation. TARDIS looks completely different on the inside. It's like, you can, I actually said to my niece, I'm like, you know, okay, you want to kind of get started with Doctor Who. She doesn't like David Tennant. And so I was like, okay, let's start with the 11th Doctor. And she started with the 11th Doctor and she watched all that. And then she watched the 9th Doctor and she's slowly working her way through David Tennant. And she still doesn't like it as much. But at least the 11th hour was a tangible jumping on point that I could give her without saying, okay, I want you to watch the last 7 seasons of Doctor Who. Let's start with Rose. You know, and I think that would have alienated her and it would have just been overload and too much for her to watch at once.
Also on the subject of the season plot arcs, the one thing I've noticed this season is the Clara arc is almost a pseudo season plot arc. The last two episodes have both touched on the Clara arc, but only actually to sort of re-explain it quickly for anyone who may have come in. Like, there's not actually been any development in the Clara arc. It's just been an excuse to re-explain the premise of her once or twice. And notably, the River Song stories always manage to find some excuse to remind you that the Doctor meets her out of order every time. And typically, actually, what I find neat about how Doctor Who does its season arcs is the finale tends to go back and tell you how it's been a season arc in a way that does not appear watching it linearly at all. It sort of retcons the season arc onto it while pretending to have a season arc that's really just reminding you of the complex bits of the premise.
And I also like how each season concludes. You know, you might not like how it concludes, but it does wrap up in some fashion where you're not like, you know, oh my God, I can't wait for next season, like American television. And then you've lost that jumping on point, you know, for the new person. Because, I mean, I can literally say, start with the second Doctor, you know, or start with the 10th Doctor, oh my gosh. or, you know, like, okay, you want to start with Classic Who, but you don't know what the heck you want to do with your life. Start with Spearhead from Space. He has an adorable relationship with his shoes. It's the beautiful love story of a man in his shoes. And there are robots or something. Having those jumping on points where you do have a new doctor or a new companion or something is just, it's a real blessing for the show to get new, I call it proselytizing for Doctor Who, to get new people interested and involved in a way that's not scary. Instead of saying, here's 50 years worth of material, go trudge through it.
We have time for one more question.
Yeah.
I was just going to add a comment to that. The same could be said for the beginning of a new companion, because that will tend to explain things for the benefit of the companion, who's our analog, so that they understand what's going on, so potentially maybe you can tell what's going on.
Squeeze one more in. How about that?
Thinking about the music, which, you know, possibly one of the more divisive things about the show right now. It seems to me that what Gold is trying to do primarily is to show the emotional beats of the characters that are going along. And in the classic series, it was more about giving a sense of the environment, of the place.
This is the scary bit.
To the people that were in there. And you know, just what people's thoughts are on the difference between classic versus modern music in the show.
That, for me, Gold is and is very talented. I love a lot of the things that I've done, but it's very much of the music now is more similar to other sorts of music on television and film. Much more so than the music in the classic series was unlike anything else, unless it was Blake Seven, basically. Like, you know, Dudley Simpson was in Blake Seven at the same time. It has a completely different function there. And so the romance, the characters, the emotional beats and everything, that's all about the music these days, you know, overwhelmingly so, and the motif and everything. And it really is, it's starting to really wear on people, just general viewers and everything like that. I'm sure all of us could probably have that little 11th Doctor theme, you know, as this awful earworm eventually, you know.
I'm not even going to utter it
because, no, we have it there. But, and it's not his fault so much because he gets a contract to do that. I would hope with a new showrunner ostensibly, theoretically coming in soon-ish, that they take that opportunity to change gears with this. Murray Gold, I would argue, I don't know if this is true or not, but I would argue he may have the longest consecutive run of credits in the series history. He's been in every new series episode on there, and he's got more credits consecutively than Dudley Simpson ever had in that. It's time to take a new tack on the function of the music if we're going to reboot that, because it's samey.
Well, one of the interesting things, too, that when you watch the new show, particularly the last two seasons, is that they're counterbalancing that a little bit by infusing more pop music. Like, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, you've got The Cult. You've got, you know, obviously it's part of the story, but you've got Ultravox in Cold War. And you go, and Torchwood did this very, very well. It's one of the things I think they brought over from Torchwood, was bringing in sort of pop music as a background
show,
to sort of balance out some of the Murray Gold, which I think is kind of nice. Although I still don't get the cult thing in Journey to the Center of the TARDIS.
But again, every other show on TV brings in pop music.
I know they do, but I think it's a nice balance out to the. I mean, I know it's a more traditional thing, and it can also allow some to issue soundtracks and make money down the line later. But it also is a nice counterbalance to the sort of oversaturation we get with Murray Gold. I think he's a great, great composer, and I think that. I'm wondering if they're keeping him on a leash and that he really is trying to really do other great things and they're sort of holding him back. Because when I hear it, I kind of hear somebody that's like really trying to get other things in there when he can. So I don't know how much control he has anymore over that.
Actually, just a quick observation, sort of end where we started. I think one thing we should probably be aware of is dividing the classic series neatly from the new, because saturation scoring came in 1980, when Dudley Simpson was kicked out. And there are actually a lot of resonances, I would suggest, between Doctor Who in the last 3 or 4 years and what's happening.
Particularly great show. Did a lot.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there, but thanks a lot. Thank all the panelists. Well, all right. The next up is Doctor Engender.